Welcome to Political Rewind. We're here in the studio with Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, also the overseer, the editor of the Political Insider blog. Jim, welcome to the show today.
Great to be here. Wouldn't miss it for the world.
And Lori Geary, the former political reporter for WSB-TV, is with us again today. She now is the CEO. Do you call yourself a CEO?
President
of a new media company.
Yeah, Lori Geary Media.
There you go.
Just enjoying it.
There you go. Mm-hmm. I'll bet there's a website involved.
There is. Thanks for the plug, Bill.
Okay. And we're very, very pleased that we have on the phone today Georgia's former United States Senator Sam Nunn. Sam Nunn served for 24 years in the United States Senate, where he became one of the leading authorities on military matters, on foreign affairs. He was the chair of the Armed Services Committee. He was the subcommittee chair of what was essentially, I think I'm right, Senator, an earlier version of the Intelligence Committee. Is that correct?
Well, it was a subcommittee on investigations, which goes way back to the infamous days of the McCarthy Committee, but we didn't run it in that direction.
Okay. Yes, I guess not. And of course, also since leaving the Senate in 1998, you were co-founder of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, a nonprofit, which you put together to try to curtail nuclear weapons, end the stockpiling of nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction, and to prevent their proliferation. And you remain as co-chair of that organization. I think I've got that right.
That's right. Ted Turner and I jointly started that, and I've been CEO and co-chair, and I remain co-chair, but former Secretary of Energy Ernie Moniz is now the CEO, and we focused for the last, almost 16 years on the question of protecting nuclear materials, making sure we don't have catastrophic terrorism, and trying to promote cooperation between the United States and Russia and the other nuclear powers to make sure we protect all nuclear materials and keep them out of dangerous hands.
Well, clearly we have you here on a day where you are going to have a lot to say about what's going on in the world.
Yeah, we're not going to call it good luck. We'll just say it's appropriate.
It is appropriate because the world is still reacting with some shock to this statement that President Trump made yesterday.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before. Thank you.
And Senator, just a few hours ago, President Trump amplified on that message by tweeting this: "My first order as president was to renovate and modernize our nuclear arsenal. It is now far stronger and more powerful than ever before. Hopefully, we will never have to use this power, but there will never be a time when we are not the most powerful nation in the world." How did you react when you heard that remark?
Well, I think, first of all, when you're dealing with North Korea, I think statements we make ought to be very carefully framed. I preferred the approach that Mattis, Secretary of Defense, took this morning with a very carefully worded statement that was very appropriate and gave the kind of warning without causing great alarm around the world and possible reactions that we don't want in North Korea and other places. In fairness to President Trump, he's trying to deter conflict by North Korea and misbehavior by conflict, but saying that we were going to respond to North Korean threats, which basically occur probably every month. North Korea always wants get attention, and they always have extreme rhetoric, and they're always making threats. Mattis basically framed his statement to talk about North Korean actions, and that's the way it ought to be framed. But one of the things that I would add is that we've got to be careful about South Korea. We can't give the impression to South Korea, our ally, and also this applies to Japan, that We care only about America, threats against America. We are sworn to help protect the South Koreans, and we need to keep that in mind because we do not want to see a split between the United States and the South Koreans based on their fear of some of our own language.
And we do have to remember that the 38th parallel is the distance between Atlanta and Marietta.
That's exactly right, and it's a very tense place, Jim. And the other thing we've got to be, I think, aware of is that we've had a real breakthrough, and this is to the credit of the Trump administration, on UN passing very strong sanctions, which will cut probably $1 billion, is estimated, from the exports of the North Koreans. And that was a big breakthrough that just happened, and I'm afraid this recent rhetoric has taken the spotlight off of that, because not only is China and U.S.-China cooperation essential to basically get North Korea to comply with the U.N. resolutions and begin to move away from their nuclear program and their nuclear weapons, but also it's a test of U.S.-China relations, which in the long run may be the most important part of all, and that is, can we work together to resolve peacefully this conflict? If we can, that's a great news not only for the North Korean question, but for U.S.-China relationship and making the world a safer place.
Senator, it's great to be here with you today, and today of all days. I thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. But my question is, can you give us your overall sense of what this situation is? Because I turned on CNN this morning, and they had a report from Hawaii saying, now, if a missile is launched, it takes 20 minutes, and Hawaiians have 20 minutes, and then this emergency blast goes on. And I was thinking to myself, are we there? Are we there yet? Or, you know, are we still, you know, there's still a great chance that this is going to be diplomatically settled.
Well, Laurie, first of all, thank you for, after being a great CEO, an important CEO, Hank, still being willing to have discussions with Jim and Bill and me.
Someone has to, right?
Putting this in perspective, I think the last thing the North Koreans would do was launch an attack against the United States. I think if they were going to do that, they realized that would be the end of not only their regime, but it would be the end of their country. And that would be particularly true if they launched a nuclear weapon. So I don't think if the people of Guam need to be alarmed about it. And I was glad Secretary Tillerson made that clear. But he also landed there and spent some hours there. So it's important for that to be put in perspective. The greater danger is an attack on South Korea. The greater danger is digging tunnels, as they've done before, perhaps even putting nuclear weapons not necessarily missiles, but on trucks. The greater danger also is selling that nuclear material to terrorists who have no return address, don't worry about deterrence, and might use it. So those are the dangers we really got to watch. But the bottom line is the North Koreans having nuclear weapons is a threat, not only to the United States, but it's a threat to the whole world, and particularly our friends and allies in South Korea and Japan.
I'm sorry. I mean, Senator, Glenn Thrush of the New York Times is reporting in the last hour or so that the statement from the president yesterday was made without consultation, that it was a relatively spontaneous statement. Although I'm surprised by that because it sounded somewhat scripted to me. Nevertheless, Thrush reports he did it without consulting people in the White House. But more important, he did it without consulting our allies, the South Koreans, for example, the British and others. What's your sense of a president who acts unilaterally and makes such an extraordinary threat?
Well, I would think we probably ought to see if General Kelly will accompany him to the golf courses when he goes, because President Trump, you know, he's got some basic good instincts on a lot of things, and obviously wouldn't be elected if he hadn't, and he appeals to an awful lot of people. But his problems almost all stem from his own rhetoric and his own tweets, which are not thought out. They can be clever, they can be entertaining, but they can also be very dangerous. So I'm hoping that the new chief of staff, he's already tried to bring some discipline to the White House, but the person that's most important to discipline is the president himself.
Senator, one thing that I've noticed over in this last week, and there's been an article in the Post and elsewhere about it, is that the North Koreans are progressing in the miniaturization issue faster than anybody expected. Is that a sign that they're getting help from other people, say perhaps China, perhaps Russia?
I think the Chinese would be very reluctant to try to help them now with their nuclear program. There's no doubt there's been some help in the past, and I suspect the Chinese regret that now because this whole scenario is a threat to China. You can imagine the people of China and what would happen if there was actually nuclear explosions on the Korean Peninsula, whether coming from North Korea or whether coming from a retaliatory strike after they have used nuclear weapons. So the Chinese, in my opinion, really want to restrain and end the nuclear program, in my view. But they also worry about other things that we have to be conscious in trying to get China to put maximum pressure on what's on China's menu. And they want to make sure that if North Korea collapses, they don't have to bear all the burden. They've right. got refugees that could stream across the border with millions of people. And they also want to make sure that if there is a collapse or a war in North Korea, which ends the regime, which I think it would do, that American troops don't end up on their borders. So one of the most important things here is for the United States and China to have very quiet, confidential talks. And I hope they're happening about what not only on our menu, but what concerns the Chinese. Both of those things have to happen if China and the United States are going to work together, which is essential for this situation to be resolved peacefully, but also much broader to bring about increased stability in a dangerous world.
And, Senator, we've heard so much about this timeline about North Korea and kind of their capabilities. What is your opinion? Are they there yet? Are they still a year out from, you know, being able to put a nuclear bomb on a missile? Like, where are they on this timeline? Because we heard from the Washington Post that some folks in the U.S. government didn't realize they were this far along, that they were a couple years out. But in your opinion, where are they?
Laurie, I think they're making a lot of progress, and that's very dangerous. They have increased the distance of their reach with their long-range missiles. They have reduced, according to recent reports, the warheads down to lower weight because lower weight is essential for more distance. And the big long pole in the tent now seems to be whether they could actually have a reentry vehicle that survived and did not get destroyed in reentering the atmosphere after a long-range flight. So all of those things they're making progress on. I don't think they're there yet. But again, we have to be careful that we don't just define this North Korea threat as a threat against America. They already can threaten South Korea mm-hmm. with nuclear weapons. They already can threaten Japan with nuclear weapons. They don't have to have a long-range missile. So while that's of great concern and we need to be focused on it, we've got to be very careful. We don't give the impression that all we're concerned about is U.S. security here. We have an mm-hmm. alliance. And if we start splitting up that alliance based on the perception in South Korea or Japan that we're not on the same wavelength in terms of protecting them, then it's going to weaken the whole alliance and make war more likely.
So America first doesn't work there?
I think it's got to be America first always, but it's got to be America first with our allies, and allies are part of our sacred obligation. So,
Senator, you know, it's interesting to me because when I hear you talk about President Trump, I hear in you a caution about not wanting to be too overly critical, and you are very fair-minded in wanting to give him credit where you think it's due, which I appreciate. But here's my bigger question on that. You know very well that a great many people in the United States think President Trump first is unfit to be president. That's fine. But more importantly, in this situation, a looming crisis of nuclear proportions, really don't trust that he's a kind of leader who can guide us through this safely. Do you want to share your thoughts about that with us?
Bill, I wrote a Wall Street Journal op-ed appeared about a month before the election in November of 16. It appeared in probably October of 16.
Yeah, we talked with you about it on this show, as a matter of fact, so talk about it again.
And I think there are a lot of characteristics President Trump has that he's got to refine and adjust if he's going to be a successful commander-in-chief as well as president. And I do worry about the loose rhetoric. I worry about the impression he gives of ready, fire, aim philosophy. I don't think he wants a war. I think he wants to deter But he's got to start listening to the good advisors around him, and he's got some good advisors, but he simply seems to not be willing to listen.
Senator, let me ask you. One of your points has been that the danger of an accidental launch of us misinterpreting another nation's moves and vice versa. But there's also there was a really interesting article in this month's edition of Scientific American, where it says that where they argue that maybe the U.S. nuclear weapon system shouldn't be under the sole control of one human being.
Well, eventually, I'd like to get rid of all nuclear weapons in the world. We're a long way from that, and the United States and the other nuclear powers have to understand that the world. Is counting on us to restrain the development of new weapons wherever we can. We have to modernize, but not create the impression that we're giving that everybody's got to have nuclear weapons or the world is not going to be safe. We can't expect nonproliferation if we don't set the example. By we, as U.S. and Russia, we cannot move unilaterally. We have to move with Russia, and we have to have China, Britain, and France and others join in at some point. But there are a lot of steps in this process. I won't go into them. I've also outlined those steps in a Wall Street Journal article with George Shultz and Bill Perry and Henry Kissinger. So this is not simply saying we want to get rid of nuclear weapons and everything goes away. The world without nuclear weapons is not today's world simply subtracting nuclear weapons. We have to take care of a lot of trouble spots. We're talking about one of them this morning, but it's also Iran. It's also India, Pakistan. So there are a lot of dangers, and we have to work these problems and let the world know that we're going to hold them accountable, other countries, for not proliferating their weapons. But we've got to be held accountable ourselves, we being the nuclear powers, for making the world safer. And right now, we're not doing that very well.
But should
particularly with U.S.-Russia confrontation.
Should the U.S. nuclear arsenal be under should the president be the only person with his finger on the trigger?
Boy, this would be a tough question if we were having a constitutional convention back in the 1700s, because I don't think the founding fathers, with their declaration of war being reserved for the Congress, ever envisioned this kind of situation. And I do believe that the President of the United States should have very close advisors around him. I don't think you can change this under the Constitution, because time is such a precious commodity when you're dealing with nuclear weapons. But one of the things I've tried to say over and over and over again and get the president of Russia as well as the president of the United States to understand this and give their military leaders the order to find ways working together to give decision makers, i.e. President Trump in this case and President Putin, more decision time. When a president has only 4, 5, 6 minutes of decision time, whatever it is, we need to do everything we can to give each president more decision time before they would have to make the God help us the decision to launch nuclear weapons against each other. The Russia and the United States have an obligation not only to their own citizens but to the world to move in that direction. An hour decision time would make a huge difference. 2 hours would make even more, a week, a month. That's the direction we've got to move in. More decision times make nuclear weapons less relevant to security in all countries. And then you can gradually move away from them.
Senator, we have to take a break. We would like to talk with you about Russia. Do you have a few more minutes after the break to talk with Russia with us?
Sure.
Thank you. In the meantime, two things. We're going to post, Olivia Rangel will post on the Political Rewind blog, which will be up right after the show today, your Wall Street Journal piece, the headline of which was "Only Hillary Clinton is Prepared for the Nuclear Threat." And we'll also post a link to the website of the Nuclear Threat Initiative so people can get more information. But stay with us for just a few more minutes. We're going to take a very short break. We'll be back with Senator Sam Nunn.
Christopher Kimball is bringing his new show, Milk Street Live, to the First Center in Atlanta September 20th. He'll reveal cooking secrets from around the world, offer taste tests, and invite audience members to join in an onstage cooking contest. Support GPB now, and you'll receive 2 orchestra-level tickets to the show. Attend an exclusive pre-show meet and greet with Christopher Kimball, and receive his newest book, Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. Go to gpb.org/milkstreet. That's gpb.org/milkstreet. And thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Lori Geary and Jim Galloway join me in the studio. Senator Sam Nunn is on the telephone. Senator, again, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I know your time is somewhat limited, but we'd be remiss if we didn't get an opportunity to talk to you for just a couple of minutes about the interesting and I think odd relationship that we have between the President of the United States and Vladimir Putin and Russia in the United States. And I sort of frame those separately because on one hand, there are those who think that relations between the Russians and the Americans are at a lower point than they've been since the Cold War. And yet we have a president who in every way seems to want to do his best to befriend Vladimir Putin. What do you make of all of that in the most general way?
Well, I think the president has probably been somewhat careless in giving the impression that he thinks Putin is a strong leader and an admirable person. I think we have all sorts of problems with Putin, but let me add, I have to add this. I think President Trump is correct in the fact that he believes that we have to get along with Russia. And that means that we have to recognize the two of us together have 90% of the nuclear weapons and nuclear material. We have to recognize that Russia is the only country that can destroy the United States while we're having lunch, even though they would be destroyed in return, a small solace to us. We have to recognize that if we're going to prevent catastrophic nuclear terrorism and keep weapons of great material out of the hands of terrorists, we've got to work with Russia. So we've got to go through these elections, rather investigations, not elections, the investigations about the elections. We've got to understand whether Russia and whether there was any collusion between the Russians and the United States citizens. We got to see whether that's a crime. All that's got to continue. But in the meantime, the world is dangerous, and we've got to communicate with the Russians. Our military needs to increase communication with the Russian military. To avoid accidents, miscalculations, we're flying planes and ships near each other in Syria and in Europe. That's extremely dangerous. We have all sorts of responsibilities together, not just to each other, but to the world. So all of these things have to be done. One of the things that I've done recently is we had a joint letter to President Putin and President Trump signed by the former Russian foreign minister, by myself, by Igor Ivanov, the Russian foreign minister, as well as Wolfgang Ischinger, former German ambassador, and Des Braun, former defense minister. And we proposed four things. One, that the two countries agree, like Gorbachev and Reagan did, a nuclear war cannot be won and must not be fought. That's an important signal to people out there on the warning systems and people who were making crucial decisions in the chain of command.
Jim? You know, it occurs to me, Senator, that 2 years ago, you and I were talking about the Republican presidential field and some of the language that they were using. I mean, specifically, I think it was Marco Rubio's use of the word thug when referring to Vladimir Putin. And now we've got a U.S. president who is doing just the opposite. And it just seems to me that we haven't found the proper balance to strike.
I think that's right. I think we have to separate Putin from the Russian people. In many respects, we have to deal with him. He's their leader, so we can't ignore him. But I think we have to understand there are an awful lot of folks in Russia who want to get along with America.
Senator, go ahead. Finish that thought.
Well, I also think we have to understand that we have dangers if we're not working with Russia, and those dangers can be injurious to the American people. So I can't explain President Trump's attraction to Putin as a person. But I do believe his underlying premise that we need to get along with the Russians is correct. But we cannot interrupt the investigations. We've got to go forward with them. We've got to find out what happened. So that's a very serious matter because the Russians have really had a pretty, not just American elections, but they have a disinformation and information warfare campaign going on against both the United States and Europe. That's an extremely dangerous.
Senator, if I can, I want to ask you, do you think Russia and China are doing enough in their part with this North Korea situation? And what I want to get at is, even if this current situation is resolved diplomatically, are we going to be here next year and the year after that? Because we've been dealing with this problem for decades.
I don't think North Korea is going to get rid of their weapons overnight. I think it's going to take time. They want a peace agreement. We still have officially only an armistice. They believe the United States embargoes and sanctions are damaging their economy. I think it's mainly their own very bad system. So we've got to deal with it over a period of time. But the main thing is stopping their nuclear test, stopping their missile test, making sure they don't continue to go forward while we're having discussions with them. But discussions with North Koreans are very important. I think those need to happen.
Senator, I'm sorry to interrupt again. If I could ask you one last question, then we know your time is valuable and we don't want to keep you too long. But I'm curious. You obviously introduced Secretary of State Tillerson at his confirmation hearings and were saying his praises. So I'm curious, two things, really. Are you comfortable that he has done the job the way you had hoped he would? Also, having worked as you did for so many years with State Department, are you at all concerned about what seems to be a dismantling to some extent of the State Department and a lack of interest in making sure there are professionals who are on the job and that those jobs that are so important can be filled under this Trump administration?
Bill, I think the State Department has gotten demoralized because of the budget cuts. And I believe that they're also understaffed. Secretary Tillerson doesn't have nearly the kind of team he needs to handle all these problems. I think he's overloaded. I think his top people are overloaded. I hope that he can get some top people confirmed. I have great trust in his own leadership and judgment. I've known him for some time, but he's off to a rough start. His first deputy was turned down by President Trump, and he's having a really slow start in getting key people in place while he's trying to handle all these problems. So mark this down as a challenged area at the moment.
Senator Sam Nunn, as you leave us, I do want you to know people have been tweeting the show as they often do. And before you leave, I want you to hear a couple of comments about you. One of them comes from at Biscuit Georgia, who says, it's really nice to hear highly intelligent commentary in an unmistakably Georgia accent from Senator Nunn. We also have other comments from people who are saying how much they appreciate hearing. J.P. Cunningham says, aside from Bill Fulbright, I've never admired more a U.S. senator than I have Sam Nunn. We need him and his insights now more. You know, if social media weren't so quick to pick up on false stories, I'd say this sounds like paving the way for you to think about public office again, Senator.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm going to start tweeting first, and then I'll stop.
Senator Nunn, we are so grateful to you for taking time. Thanks for being with us on Political Rewind today and sharing your insights.
Thanks, Bill, Jim, Laurie.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're going to get our second break of the show out of the way and come back. We'll talk a little bit about what Senator Nunn had to say. We also have a big headline, news reports this afternoon. It happened a while ago, apparently on July 25th, but it's just being reported today that the FBI went into Paul Manafort's home and executed a search warrant to get records on his financial dealings and any other things they were looking at. We'll talk about that and more after the break.
On the next Fresh Air, a California physician grapples with how and when to implement her state's new End of Life Option Act, which allows certain terminally ill patients to receive medical assistance to hasten death. Dr. Jessica Nuttick-Zitter is a critical care and palliative care specialist who often treats terminally ill patients. Join us.
Fresh Air is today at 3 on GPB.
We're back on Political Rewind. Lori Geary, former political reporter for WSB-TV, and Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim, you always give us a preview. What's tomorrow's column?
Well, the city of Atlanta is trying something very new. They're trying to annex those 744 acres with Emory University on it, but they don't want to expand the school system to match that footprint.
And what's the implication of that?
Well, we've never done this before. It would be precedent setting, and it could set the terms for future expansion of the city.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to reading it. And, you know, we're going to have to dig into that in much more depth on this show in the weeks ahead. Is the City Council, Atlanta City Council, still scheduled to vote on the annexation in first week of September?
Yes, yes.
All right.
And I think they'll hit that. But then it's going to move to court.
Yes, of course. All right. Lori Geary, it's interesting the kind of, we've gotten a tweet. We have one of our favorite tweeters is Ted Barfield, and he's convinced, as he says, wasting 30 minutes trying to draw Sam Nunn into Trump criticism rather than on his insights and experience is journo malpractice. I agree with him sometimes, but I thought Sam Nunn had plenty of time to talk about what he thinks about these situations.
I also think that Senator Nunn kind of rose above any rhetoric, and he talked about where President Trump was correct, and that, you know, he was giving him credit because of, you know, Russia and China actually agreeing with the sanctions, and that, you know, he even said America first, but America first with its allies also.
Yeah.
So, I think he was very candid and truthful, but I think, you know, he wasn't political.
No, I think he was trying to thread that needle where he makes his point without kind of setting off any alarms in the Trump camp. Because if you're overly critical, if you're trying to get a message across to the Trump administration and you're overly critical, they'll shut you down.
Well,
they'll shut you down very quickly.
Right.
Yes.
I want to pick up on something you asked him about, Lori, and I want us to discuss it here. You mentioned that CNN this morning did a piece in which they described how a nuclear attack could unfold. And a number of news organizations today have done something very similar. What would it look like if? And I wonder if, in fact, this isn't one of, you know, the media is going to be and has been critical of the extreme bellicosity of the president's remarks yesterday. But I wonder if the media doesn't share in the blame in terms of inflaming the situation with the kind of story. It scared you.
It's just...
And the question is, we're not even close to this.
And yes, and let me kind of tell you, like on a much smaller scale, it reminded me during the hurricanes, when the hurricanes would hit, you know, Louisiana and Texas, and we knew as journalists getting information from the governor's office that there was going to be some type of gas shortage. And we had such discussions in our newsroom on how we report that, how we say that, because we didn't want to panic at the pumps, because there would be enough gas for everybody as long as not everybody went to the pumps all at the same time. And so I've got to think that those discussions are happening on a much higher level in the newsrooms across this country, especially at the networks. And I mean, you heard it from Senator Nunn, who is a leading expert on nuclear arms, that we're far away from that. So to even be reporting stories that say the what if, I think is a little bit premature.
I'm going to push back a little bit on that here. I mean, the problem all along, and this occurred during the campaign, was, you know, I think as somebody said, we the journalists took Trump literally but not seriously. No, seriously, but not literally. His people took him literally. Seriously, not literally.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go.
There you go.
There we go. when you've got a president talking about bringing down fire and fury on a country, and those are very specific words, and they're pulled out of the nuclear vocabulary. When he is in front of the camera and he says those words very deliberately, I think we're under an obligation to treat that just as seriously as
but
we possibly can. Now, once we get some signals from his keepers, from his associates, who say, no, that was just spur of the moment, that was just some disconnected rhetoric, then I think, yes, we have an obligation to pull back.
Well, I think, though, if you heard Rex Tillerson's comments, they were much more
tempered
than they were.
Yeah,
and that happened
a few hours later. Yeah.
But if you're saying that's what you expect, well, that's what we got. And so I also think that if you hear a lot of the analysts today, they were saying that the fire and fury was more aimed at China to make sure that China was not going to, you know, help in any way or put the pressure more on China than it was for North Korea.
Yeah, we didn't get to talk about that with Senator Nunn. It would have been interesting to have heard his take on that. But that's right. Some of the analysts suggest that Trump was aiming his remarks at China, that the point being he wants to make it clear to the Chinese government that we are serious about shutting down the nuclear threat that North Korea poses.
And I understand that, but to Nunn's point is when a U.S. president says fire and fury, that may mean one thing in White House circles and within the Beltway. In Japan, on the anniversary of Nagasaki, that means something else.
Well, you know, we didn't, and thank you for mentioning that. That is absolutely right. Today is the 72nd anniversary of the atomic bombing of Nagasaki. It came 3 days after the first atomic bomb was used in against an enemy, the Japanese, at Hiroshima. So it is especially chilling that we are all having conversations about the threat of nuclear war on this particular day. Yeah, I agree with that. I still think, Jim, that we in the media can go a couple of different ways with this. The headline can be Trump associates tamp down the president's rhetoric, or here's what it'll look like if it happens. And I'm not sure that some news organizations didn't make the more sensational choice.
Well, I will tell you what. Here's the thing was, this happened, what time did this happen yesterday? Maybe 2 o'clock or so?
A little later than that, but mid-afternoon.
2 o'clock. Yeah. Okay, but what you have, yes, we're on a 24-hour news cycle, but we're also on a world news cycle.
In different time zones.
Different time zones. And, you know, the Asia was fast asleep when this happened. So you had to give them time to wake up and consider those words.
Okay, well, the president has gotten a lot of pushback from leaders in the Asian sphere. In New Zealand, he's been heavily criticized for this. The Australian prime minister, who he already doesn't have a particularly strong relationship with, was somewhat tempered in his remarks, but nevertheless was critical. And the biggest concern, and we talked about it with Senator Nunn, is that this came without any consultation. Imagine yourself being a government official in South Korea and waking up, as Galloway said, they're sleeping in the middle, to the news that the president has made a remark that could possibly expose your entire country to an attack from North Korea without any warning that it was, you know, that the president was going to make this comment. It's a little bit surprising.
And I think Senator Nunn said it best. You have to be careful. I mean, this is not a tweet, you know, on healthcare, or it's not a political tweet. It's not. I mean, this is about possible nuclear war. And so, his comments were like his tweets, and to a certain degree that maybe they're not thought out. And the fire and the fury came out, and, it's tough to roll those types of comments back.
Yeah. All right, let's turn to, obviously, this is a situation we'll keep track of as we move forward. By the way, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB, as so many of you have. We'll try to read some of your tweets at some point before the show is over. Jim, why don't we go back to a story that happened last week, but we did not get much of an opportunity to talk about it in political rewind. Let's bring it back to Georgia if we can. The Democrats in the state house, had an election for a minority leader to replace Stacey Abrams, who, of course, has gone off to run for governor. And they made what seemed to a lot of outsiders as an unlikely choice, Representative Bob Trammell.
Bob Trammell. He's a newcomer. I think he first came to the legislature in January of 15. So he hasn't been around that long. He was running against Carolyn Hughley of Columbus, yep, a 24-year veteran, was his main appointment.
Yep.
Although Winfred Dukes was in there as well of LaGrange. What was interesting is that in the context of a gubernatorial race, this was interesting. Now I talked to Trammell himself, and he said no, that those dynamics didn't apply. But you've had a Democratic caucus that has really chafed at some of the things that Stacey Abrams, who was the previous Democratic leader, has done, including her decisions to work with Governor Deal on a number of issues, and And what I was told, not by Trammell, but by many, many people in that in that caucus, was that this was kind of a little whiplash from the Abrams years. What's interesting is, of course, the caucus is overwhelmingly African American. Hughley is African American. Bob Trammell is white.
And the question becomes whether it comes at a time when we are seeing. I want to be careful about the language I use, Laurie and Jim, because it's not a struggle for the soul of the party. That would be a little bit of an
exaggeration. No, it's always been a balancing act
in a
bipartisan coalition.
Well, and it plays out as we watch the gubernatorial campaigns of Stacey Evans and Stacey Abrams play out. We've talked about that on this show before, which is that Stacey Abrams would say to you that Evans, with the support of the Roy Barnes wing of the party, represents the old days of the Georgia Democratic Party when white rural voters had a big influence on politics. Abrams, of course, would say, we're in a new time. Diversity is the only ticket for success of Democrats. And here you have a white, young white Democratic representative beating a veteran African-American, Carolyn Hughley, for this post. And so it does play into that very same dynamic to some extent, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Trammell is from Luthersville. Yeah. He's a tiny town. He's from his dad was mayor there. He was an old college professor, as I recall. And, he is low-key, but I'm told he's extremely bright, good on his feet. He made his mark. He, as I said, he's only been around there 2.5 years. He's made his mark with a couple of speeches on his opposition to campus carry.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because in the article in the AJC, it talks about how he's willing to cut deals with Republicans when there's common ground. So will we have some of the likes of Representative Stacey Abrams? And that's the reason he perhaps got into the position that he is in. But he's also a hardliner on Medicaid expansion and some of the more Democratic policies. So it'll be interesting to see his style. I think Stacey Abrams also she wasn't a showboat type of politician. You know, I mean, she was very calculated, very knowledgeable on every issue. I mean, anytime you went to interview her, especially on education, on the Hope. So it'll be interesting to see. It's just another lawyer, too.
Laurie, to be a Democrat in the Georgia State House of Representatives is, even if you're the minority leader, you're fighting upstream every single day, aren't you?
Absolutely. I mean, there's just no other way to put it right now.
It takes a lot of humility to be a Democrat in the Capitol right now.
But the Republicans were saying that 20 years ago.
Right. Yeah. And that's what a lot of this tension is. Every Democrat looks at the state's demographics, knows they're changing in favor of Democrats. So you're trying to think maybe 5, 6, 7 years ahead and where you're going to be, and you would like to be leading the parade when that shift actually comes.
It's all in the timing.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it'll be interesting to see what Trammell does. We'll see if we can get him on this show at some point. Although, everything I've read about him is that he's just so low-key that he very rarely does media, doesn't like to be in front of the cameras, that sort of thing.
Ooh, I'm glad
No. This is the radio. This is radio. You don't have to. You're not in front of the camera.
You can wear jeans you're doing our show. Let's move on to a subject. I want to jump around just a bit, if I may, because this really caught my attention the other day. We know that President Trump has decided that the best way to counter the stories about him that he thinks are unfair is to declare war on the fake news media. I think it's been interesting that the National Rifle Association has decided to jump into that fight right there with him. They released a series of TV ads that are very, very pro-Trump in talking to the kind of voter that came out for Donald Trump, his base. They released one late Thursday, early Friday. Their spokeswoman is Dana Loesch, and I wanted to play it for you. because I think it says a lot about where organizations that support the president, well, where this one organization is headed in supporting the president on, in his war on the media.
We the people have had it. We've had it with your narratives, your propaganda, your fake news. We've had it with your constant protection of your Democrat overlords, your refusal to acknowledge any truth that upsets the fragile construct that you believe is real life. And we've had it with your pretentious, tone-deaf assertion that you are, in any way, truth or fact-based journalism. Consider this the shot across your proverbial bow. We're going to fisk the New York Times and find out just what deep rich means to this old gray hag, this untrustworthy, dishonest rag that has subsisted on the welfare of mediocrity for one, two, three more decades. We're going to laser focus on your so-called honest pursuit of truth. In short, we're coming for you.
All right. So that's Dana Loesch of the NRA. Making a declaration that NRA is going after the New York Times specifically. So a couple things about this, Jim. Number one, aside from the fact that maybe she ought to be taking on the North Koreans, this is so incredibly over the top. But I have to wonder, is this really what all our NRA members, do they buy into this kind of message? Not all NRA members are Trump voters, or forget about even that, are haters of the media the way this ad is.
Well, there's a couple things are working here. First of all, I think the New York Times has been in business more than a couple of decades.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I think it's a century or so. But what you're seeing here is this is kind of the parallel to President Trump's attacks on the media. And I think what we're seeing here is the beginning of an effort to establish through YouTube. YouTube is very important in this.
That's right.
and other elements, a kind of an alternative, your alternative media. The president, of course, has set up what, the Trump channel? Mm-hmm. We've got a Trump channel now. This is Laura
Trump, his daughter-in-law, is the anchor woman.
Right. This is kind of I would say it's probably part of that effort. And it reads a whole lot. It sounds very, very much like something that the NRA put out maybe 2 weeks ago, except their target was the Washington Post, using much the same language. And there was a little bit more motivation there, because the Post in April had done a piece that noted how NRA officials had cozied up to Vladimir Putin.
And that is my point, Lori. The question, look, if you're attacked and feel you need to fire back, as they did at the Washington Post, they used inflated rhetoric in that ad as well. Nevertheless, if you feel you've been attacked by a news story, fine. You want to respond. This notion that the NRA has decided to take on specifically the New York Times, I would be willing to bet there are a lot of members of the NRA who have subscriptions to the New York Times and think that it's a newspaper worthy of their attention. So I'm just wondering, in the long run, what this does to the membership at NRA.
Nothing.
Nothing?
In the long run, you've got to think about, if you were at the Trump rallies, this is what got Trump and his supporters all fired up. He would name members of the media on those stages and say, liar, loser, and everybody got fired up, and everybody would boo, and everybody would point fingers. And it's just a way to fire up that base. That's what this advertisement
does. You know, Bill, what was it? Today's Wednesday. Yes, excuse me. Today's on Monday. We had Theron Johnson here, who is, and we were talking about the Procter & Gamble ad, the video that shows black mothers talking to their children.
Yep.
You know, and he was asking, you know, why a business would do that. And what my theory is that polarization is bad business, and for most businesses it is, but polarization for certain niche businesses, and the NRA is one of them, is very, very valuable.
That's a good point. And guess what? We're talking about it. We're talking about this ad.
Absolutely. Well, it'll be interesting to see how that develops. I promise we're getting close to the end of the show. I said that I'd read some of your tweets. I want to be candid with you. Your tweets to the show, you can look at them yourselves, are kind of breaking down to a lot of people saying they liked the interview with Sam Nunn, and a couple others saying they thought we were trying to get him to attack Trump. So I'm not sure it's terribly productive to read them. But we do appreciate your tweeting and hope you continue to do so. So we are just about out of time. I have enough time to tell you that we have a really interesting two-way street tomorrow at 2 o'clock. We're going to be talking to a woman at Georgia Tech who is considered one of the most outstanding authorities on robotics.
I love it already.
You like robots?
This is great. No, I love the fact that it's a female talking about robotics.
Well, that's exact. She calls herself a blurred, a black nerd who grew up loving the sciences. Her name is Ayanna Howard. She was very involved in programming the Mars rover in teaching it how to move independently of instructions from Earth. We'll talk about that. And we'll also talk about whether robots are going to take over the world someday. It's really a fun show, so I hope you join us for that show tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And then we're back on Friday, and looking forward to seeing you on Political Rewind for our 3 o'clock show. In the meantime, Jim Galloway, see you again next week. Lori Geary, what a pleasure. It's always fun when your busy corporation allows you the time to come in here and spend the show, be on the show with us.
It's
Thanks
fun.
For being here.
Just like old times.
So as we leave you today, I like a lot of people, I was made really sad reading the news that Glenn Campbell had passed away yesterday. Glenn Campbell was an original in the kind of crossover country music, popular music genre. He made an enormous number of hits in his career. And one of his most successful partnerships was with the great, great singer-songwriter Jimmy Webb. Together they made maybe 40 records that Jimmy Webb wrote for Glenn Campbell. So I thought as we left you today, I would leave a little extra time at the end of the show so we could say so long to the great Glenn Campbell and do that with hearing one of his best songs written by Jimmy Webb. See you all again on Friday.
County, and I drive the